I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Hibernating bats throughout the Northeast are experiencing extensive mortality from white nose syndrome, a fungus that appears on a bat's muzzle and other body parts. The northern long-eared bat has taken such a hit that earlier this year it was listed as threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. There is a glimmer of hope, however. Northern long-eared bats on Martha's Vineyard have so far displayed no signs of white nose syndrome. Here to talk about the northern long-eared bat and the response to white nose syndrome, Jonathan Reichard, National White Nose Syndrome Assistant Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He joins us on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us a little bit more about white nose syndrome. What is it exactly, and how does it impact the bats?
So as you say, white nose syndrome is a disease that's affecting bats. It's caused by a pathogenic fungus that has been identified because of the observations of the disease. The fungus is called Pseudogymnoascus destructens, which we refer to as PD. The fungus invades the skin of bats and leads to a series of effects in physiology, behavior, that ultimately in many cases kill bats.
Now, we're talking about the northern long-eared bat, but how many different species of bats do we see in Massachusetts?
We have seven species that are native to Massachusetts, and we've seen some of those are hibernating species, some are migrating species, and then we've seen white nose syndrome in all of the hibernating species that exist here.
So some bats hibernate for the winter months, others migrate, as you said. So explain how this makes certain species more vulnerable to white nose syndrome and how it causes the spread of the disease.
The pathogenic fungus, PD, is a cold-loving fungus. It grows optimally in the 12 to 16 degree Celsius range, 55 to 60 degree range, which also coincides with the temperature conditions that bats prefer to hibernate in. So by having a pathogen that likes to grow in this cold environment and bats that rely on that cold environment to hibernate through the winter, there's a perfect match for the pathogen to affect these species.
Do we have any idea of how many bats have been infected and died as a result of this?
That's a really challenging question. Going back to before white nose syndrome, we didn't really have a good idea of how many bats there were to begin with. So to put a number on how many have been affected and died from white nose is a real challenge. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and a number of state agencies and some quantitative ecologists did get together and try to estimate how many bats probably have died from white nose syndrome, and that estimate several years ago was over 5 million bats.
Wow.
That hasn't been revisited lately, and we have more information now, but many, many bats, and putting an exact number on it's been a big challenge. We can say that bats that we have counted over the years and have been able to monitor specific colonies, we can look at proportional declines in those colonies, but not really a great mm-hmm. estimate of exact numbers that have died.
Yeah. Do we know if bats can live with this white nose syndrome, or is it always fatal?
It varies depending on the species we're talking about, and in some cases, depending on the site or the location, it seems. So white nose syndrome has only really been known to science for 7-8 years, and we've really learned a lot about it in that time. When we first started looking at it, it did look like every bat that was infected with the fungus was going to die. We've since then seen that some will survive. Some species that have been identified with white nose syndrome, with the infections that characterize white nose syndrome, do not seem to show any real declines in the population sizes. So we think those bats have survived. Yeah. We also see individuals of species that are highly affected by the disease. We see individuals that have survived multiple years with some evidence of having suffered the disease and lived through it or recovered.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, why they survive and others don't, huh?
It's a really interesting one. I wish I had the answer.
Now, so you said this, that white nose syndrome is only, we've only known about it for 7 or 8 years, but has it been around longer than that, or is this something new?
It seems to be new in North America. Our best evidence suggests it has been present in North America for only that period of time, maybe a couple of years longer, undetected prior to our knowing about it. Again, since attention has been given it with the declines we saw here, researchers in Europe have found 11 bat species throughout Europe that, largely in the Czech Republic area, 11 species that have the disease, that get the same infections, and a couple more that carry the fungus without the infections. Yeah. Our best hypotheses there are that there's a long evolutionary history in Europe with bats and this pathogen coexisting.
Yeah. So do we know where this originated from, this white nose syndrome, where it might have started, or do we have no idea?
We don't know exactly where. We have evidence pointing toward it could have come from Europe. Some recent genetic work has revealed that it may be from Europe. There are some close connections with the genetics of North American PD and genetics of the molecular analyses of European PD. Mm-hmm. We don't have direct evidence that it came from Europe, and to be honest, a lot of our searching beyond Europe has been limited. Mm-hmm. So we haven't really looked for the fungus elsewhere to a great extent at this point.
So do we think that it came to North America with migrating bats? Is that how we think it got here, or is there some other way?
There are no bats that we know of that regularly migrate between Europe and North America. Mm. There could be a transport of the fungus on a bat across the ocean, but it would not be by sort of natural occurrences.
So that be on a boat or something.
Either through a storm or a bat on a boat, exactly, has been hypothesized, or in a shipping container or something like that. Alternatively, one of our sort of leading hypotheses that's led to a lot of our precautionary recommendations and regulations is that it could have come over on dirty boots, mm-hmm. on a dirty backpack or something like that.
Wow. So maybe you can explain the role of bats in the ecosystem and the potential impacts of a large die-off of bats.
Sure. In North America, at least in the Northeast, all of our bats are insectivorous. So these are the primary consumers of insects at night, and they eat a wide variety of insects, everything from annoying pests that bother us as we're barbecuing in the backyard to agricultural and forest pests that are damaging crops and trees. So by removing those predators, those pest populations go a little bit unmitigated by their predator. Quantifying and really identifying how that will affect the ecosystem is another big challenge. You know, bats are largely, at least here, our insectivorous bats are largely generalist predators. So they will not have a specific insect population necessarily that they keep in check. A number of researchers are in the process of trying to identify exactly what the ecosystem services are or were that may be affected by the declines.
You know, one of the things they eat are mosquitoes.
They can eat mosquitoes for sure.
Yeah. So when we think about all the things, you know, the West Nile virus and, you know, other things that mosquitoes carry, we don't want to see more mosquitoes, right?
Right. That role of potential public health service that they provide is another big one. And again, that hasn't been quantified at this point.
Yeah. Now, earlier this year, the northern long-eared bat was listed as a federally threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. What's the plan and the priorities of Fish and Wildlife when it comes to protecting this species?
So the listing as threatened provides the bat with a number of protections against intentional killing and harming and harassing. It also protects some of the known habitat that we have for these species where they're still occurring. The recovery plan that comes with a threatened species or an endangered species is in development, and the Fish and Wildlife Service is currently working on the outline for that plan.
Are there other bats that are in Massachusetts that are also declining in big numbers, or is it mostly just this northern long-eared bat?
The three species that have experienced the largest declines from white-nose syndrome are the northern long-eared bat, the little brown bat, and the tricolored bat in our area. And they've all experienced fairly similar declines, with the northern long-eared bat being the greatest percentage decline that we can measure at the winter sites.
Now, you mentioned there were seven different species of bats, and the three that you mentioned that have been impacted the most all sound like very small bats. Am I right? Are they all?
They are small. Yeah.
And the bigger.
And in fact, all of our bats are pretty small. Yeah. But for the most part, these are among the smaller.
Yeah.
In
and
our area.
So you said little brown bat. Are there big brown bats?
There are big brown bats as well. So if the little brown bat's body is about the size of the last tip of my thumb, the big brown bat's body is about the size of my whole thumb. So it's really not all that big.
Yeah.
But relative to the little brown, it's bigger.
Okay, so that's four. What are the other three species that we see?
So there's the eastern small-footed bat as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have three migratory bats, the red bat, the hoary bat, and the silver-haired bat.
Are they easy to tell apart? I mean, you mentioned that, like, with the little brown and the big brown, they're just, you know, a little bit different in size. Do they? Because I'm thinking, you know, I didn't realize we had seven species of bats. I see a bat, I think they're all the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the little brown bat and the big brown bat are pretty distinct looking. They're different. So the little brown bat is a Myotis species, and the big brown bat is an Eptesicus species, and they have a quite different look to them. The little brown bat, the northern long-eared bat, and to some extent the eastern small-footed bat are all Myotis, and they look quite similar. There are differences that you can certainly see, but you wouldn't see them. You certainly wouldn't see them as the bats flying by you, or even from a distance, it'd be difficult to tell.
Yeah. So what?
And the tricolored bat is similar to those in size, but has some unique characteristics.
So of those seven species we see in Massachusetts, how many do we see here on the Cape and Islands?
I believe you see all of them. I don't know if there's a small-footed bat, an eastern small-footed bat record out there.
Yeah, but are the other six?
I believe they're all there.
Yeah. We are talking about bat research with Jonathan Reichard, National White-Nose Syndrome Assistant Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to ask a question or chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about white-nose syndrome, a fungus that is affecting the northern long-eared bat as well as some others. On the phone, Jonathan Reichard, National White-Nose Syndrome Assistant Coordinator for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And in studio, we have Luann Johnson, Director and Wildlife Biologist at Biodiversity Works. Hi, Luann.
Hey,
to
Mindy.
See you again. And Liz Baldwin, Assistant Director and Wildlife Biologist at Biodiversity Works. Hi, Liz. Good
Hi,
to
Mindy.
See you as well. Luann, throughout the Northeast, we've seen a die-off of the northern long-eared bat, as we've been saying. But in 2012, there were some roosting bats found on the vineyard that appeared to be disease-free. So tell us about that.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. So one of the things is that these bats were actually found roosting in a bluebird box on the Nature Conservancy's Hoff Farm Preserve. The staff there were checking the boxes that they usually do late summer, and Liz Laux, their land steward, found a bat and took a picture. And it was a female with a volant pup, and that was exciting. So we shared that with Fish and Wildlife, and they were thrilled to see that, as it was a period of time when white nose had appeared and these bats were dying everywhere. So we followed up in 2013 with some mist netting surveys, and we actually captured some lactating females, which was exciting. And then this year we've been following up some more on that on Martha's Vineyard.
Mm. And Liz, you've been working to determine maternity roost sites on the vineyard. How do you do that?
Several ways. So First, Kendra Burrush did work in the 90s, 97, 98. So we had some baseline information about where she was catching northern long-eared bats. And so we put up mist nets in those areas. And once we caught a few northern long-eared, we put a tag on them. And it's just a little nano tag, quite small. And we attach it with eyelash glue. Who knew that works? And then with a receiver and antenna, the next day we follow that bat to wherever it is. And hopefully, we hope it's a maternity colony. And then that night, once we found that location, that night we sit out around dusk and see how many bats come out. Also, the first thing we do is we tag only the females. So we're hoping that the female will then lead us to that colony. Mm-hmm. And then when we see a bunch of bats coming out, we count them, and then we try to net that site as well and see if there are more females in there. Mm.
John, talk about, you get this call and we say, hey, we've got these long-eared bats on the vineyard who don't have white nose syndrome. That must have been a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, it was. Susie von Ottingen from our field office up in New Hampshire was the first to chime in on this and pass it our way. And we, with this observation and other sort of trickling in anecdotes of we're still catching northerns, especially in places that seem to be in coastal regions, we started to look into this. And yeah, it was very exciting when we're talking with inland biologists who haven't seen a northern in a couple of years. And then we get these reports.
Right. Luann, what are some of the challenges of working with this species of bat?
Well, I think for us, it's we're in netting in forest habitats. So it's working at night, which is when you work all day, too. That can make for a long day. Liz and I didn't get a lot of sleep this summer. So you're out in buggy conditions and all of that, but they're not very abundant. So you're sometimes just out. You spend a lot of time setting up your nets, and you're out there for 5 hours at night and not maybe catching any bats at all, which can be pretty depressing. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's the biggest challenge. It's just a lot of effort
waiting around.
However, we've been much more fortunate in catching this species of bat than anyone else in the Northeast this summer, from what I'm hearing all around.
Yeah. So, Liz, the two of you were out there just kind of twiddling your thumbs some nights.
Eating lots of chocolate.
So, John, do we find this northern long-eared bat throughout New England?
We used to. It used to be a very, very common bat to encounter in forested areas. So any mis-netting efforts that would occur in forested areas would very regularly encounter this species.
Yeah. So do we have a good baseline of data on the northern long-eared bat in other regions of the Northeast, or is there still a lot there that we need to learn?
There's still a lot to learn. As with any of these bats, there are a couple of bat species where we have good baseline population data, and unfortunately that probably exists because those were species that were listed as endangered decades ago and have been monitored that closely. Otherwise, a lot of the winter surveys and other estimates of the population have been either focused on the endangered species or sort of sporadic and not as thorough. We also don't get a great estimate of summer population distribution from mist-netting efforts and from acoustic piecemeal acoustic surveys. We can get localized estimates of abundance, but not a great population-wide estimate. But one of the things that came from the impacts of white nose syndrome was a sort of reinvigorating of a discussion to really try to get this good baseline information, and a group of scientists from USGS and Fish and Wildlife Service, Forest Service, state agencies, and National Park Service have developed the North American Bat Monitoring Program, which is designed to do through a strategic sampling effort designed to use acoustic and other counts of bat species to really try to get at that good estimate of populations. or for multiple species.
And we're talking about the different species of bats that we find on the Cape and Islands. So how are you determining, I mean, when you get them in the nets, obviously you can see what you have, but is there a lot of like with bird calls, like are there bat calls, like you're listening for different calls, or are they all, do they all sound the same?
They all sound the same. Well, we can't hear them. Mm-hmm. We have these bat detectors that we can put out, and they record the calls, and then there's software that can then decipher the different species.
Wow. Interesting.
And then once they're in the hand, then we can
see what you have.
See what we have.
Yeah. Yeah. Janet is giving us a call from West Tisbury. Good morning, Janet.
I have several bat stories to tell.
Okay.
Sometimes this time of year, I will see bats, or not very many, flying way up high hunting. They must be getting mosquitoes mm-hmm. in my yard.
Yeah.
So that happens. And another time, I had one get in my bedroom. And flew over my face.
Oh, my.
And I tried to get it out of the house. I opened the doors. It was about 2 in the morning. And I couldn't do it. And so it flew around. I have a loft over the kitchen. And it ended up going up and sleeping on a beam up there. And I called the animal control officer the next day. And she came with a crab net. And we caught it. I said, try not to hurt it. She was very good. She didn't hurt it, and we put it out a window.
Janet, thank you for not hurting the bat.
I love that.
I do, too. But, you know, so many people are really, they have this kind of irrational fear. So let's talk about that. Janet, thank you for the phone call. I don't know who wants to chime in here, but people are scared of bats. Should they be?
I'll jump in there. Bats are mysterious in a lot of ways, and they do end up in people's houses, and they fly around in the dark, and you see a silhouette whizzing by, and they can be scary, I guess, in that way. So I think it's a curiosity, a concerned curiosity that a lot of us have for it. We've lived for the large part, we've lived very safely with bats very close to us, and as Janet was saying, you know, even living in our own houses without great concern. That said, bats can carry rabies, and it's important to treat that with respect. Mm-hmm. Rabies is a disease that we don't mess around with. Mm-hmm. So we do everything we can to encourage people to avoid contacting bats. Those who work with bats get vaccinated for rabies and wear protection on our hands if we're handling bats to avoid that risk. Mm-hmm. So it is appropriate to treat them with concern.
Yeah.
They end up in your house, and for the most part, if that happens, especially if they're in your room, they don't want to be there either.
Yeah.
So opening a window or a door and trying to get them to leave, especially if you can keep yourself away from them while they're doing that is the best approach.
They're probably as scared as we are of them, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and then I think the rabies thing is probably what a lot of people fear, that they think there's, you know, most bats have rabies. How many, John, maybe you know the answer to this, are they really that high in number of bats that carry rabies? Or, I mean, what's the potential threat there?
It's a low percentage.
So low percentage.
Most bats that are submitted for testing do not have rabies. And I should have a percentage, exact percentage, but I do not.
Mm-hmm. I've seen recent numbers.
You know, less than 5% of the bats that are submitted for testing have rabies.
Okay.
And that are submitted part is important, because if they're submitted, it's usually a bat that's acting abnormally, right? And
right.
So that's one that you would expect to see a higher prevalence of a disease that causes bats to act abnormally.
Right. And Luann, before we went on the air, we were talking about the fact that bats aren't the only animals that carry rabies. So, and I mean, you shouldn't touch wild animals, period, right?
No, you should always wear gloves if you're handling a wild animal, no matter what you're doing. particularly mammals. Mm-hmm. Any mammal can carry rabies, so you should always be very cautious.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email still down today, so no email. We also have a slideshow of Liz and Luann conducting field work with bats at our website, capeandislands.org. You might want to check that out. Luann, Liz, I don't know who wants to answer this. How are you collaborating with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on your work with the northern long-eared bat?
So we've been we started in 2013 with collaborating with Fish and Wildlife. We had a contract with them to actually do the first mist netting to follow up after Kendra's work in 97-98. And then this year we're collaborating with Fish and Wildlife and with UMass grad student Zara Dowling and also BOEM, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, to start this larger, this study that we started this summer. Our Biodiversity Works, our focus is a maternity roosting study that was funded through a Martha's Vineyard Vision Fellowship. Mm-hmm. And we are looking, trying to understand maternity roosting behavior in the females and also roosting at this time of year in males and females. And then Zara's work is involving towers that can pick up and read these nano tags that mm-hmm. we attach to the bats. The towers should go up in the spring of 2016 now on the coast. We'll have just four. They're about 40-foot towers. We're approved to have one at Tarpaulin Cove on Nashon. Then there'll be one on the coast near Lambert's Cove in a sort of a spot that's sort of not very visible. And there was one approved near at the Nature Conservancy's Hoff Farm Field Station, and then one near Cedar Tree Neck, not far from Cedar Tree Neck. And those would tell us if bats are flying offshore.
Mm-hmm. So this is to assess the potential impact of offshore wind?
The BOEM is interested in and whether or not bats are flying in the waters offshore Martha's Vineyard that might have wind development, yes. And our collaborative piece of that is that from that data, we can also learn whether or not bats are leaving Martha's Vineyard during migration season, mm-hmm. which would help us quite a bit in determining whether or not the reason Martha's Vineyard still has some of these bats is, in fact, because they're hibernating somewhere on Martha's Vineyard.
Right, they're not moving around.
Maybe. Yeah, we have no idea. So we're doing the first roosting maternity roost study in Massachusetts. Nobody's ever
done it before. Wow.
No. So we're in some of the first coastal work, and you know, there's not that much work on these coastal populations of bats, as John was saying.
Right.
So we're learning quite a bit.
Yeah. John, do we know, I mean, we mentioned that some of the, I guess, groups of these bats that, like on the vineyard, who are not showing signs of white nose syndrome seem to be in some coastal areas. What does that tell us anything? I mean, what might be, why might that be?
Another good question. As Luann was saying, there is a chance that they have not been exposed to the disease yet, or to the pathogen, I should say. If they're staying local on the island without other bats moving back and forth between these contaminated sites on the mainland, the pathogen may not have reached out there. Mm. We have decontamination protocols in place and are really attentive to making sure that we, the researchers, aren't the ones who actually bring it out there, if that
right.
is the case.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Alternatively, they could be clearing themselves of the disease or of the fungus before they are observed in the summertime. So mm-hmm. bats that survive a winter in a contaminated site do, in many cases, heal, or in some cases at least, some documented cases, can heal and will rid themselves of the fungus before they're really established in their summer roosts. Mm-hmm. So a northern long-eared bat could leave a cave in Vermont fully infected with PD, heal by the time it gets to Martha's Vineyard, and then by the time Luann and Liz trap it, they don't see any evidence of the disease.
That's interesting. So do we see this white nose syndrome being, I mean, is it change, you know, from one species of a bat to another? I mean, do they share the same areas, like, you know, in the cave or wherever they roost?
Yes, the caves mostly have mixed populations, so a mixed colony of multiple bat species. We fully expect that bats are the primary transmitters of the fungus. They're carrying the fungus from one site to another, and then spores are being transmitted from one bat to another bat, or from a bat to the cave wall, and then to another bat. There are some patterns that people are investigating to see if there are particular bat species that are more directly involved in that transmission or distribution part of the disease cycle than other species are. But those aren't entirely clear yet.
All right. Joel is giving us a call from Brewster. Hi, Joel.
Hi. I may have missed it, but as you mentioned, exactly how this fungus destroys the bats, how they succumb to it?
We don't really know exactly. The exact mechanism that leads to death is still under investigation. What we know is that it's likely multifaceted. So the fungus arrives on the bat, it invades the skin of the bat, and then that leads to multiple physiological responses and immunological responses and behavioral responses. But in the end, again, in many or most cases, in some species, leads to the bat dying. Mm. This all happens during hibernation, so there's some component of limited access to food and energy reserves. The bats are surviving on their body fat, their stored body fat, through the period when they get infected. And in a lot of cases, they don't have an opportunity to raise their body temperatures to what we call a euthermic state, where their elevated body temperature could allow them to fight off an infection. Because it's so cold in the winter, or even in these winter sites, doing so, raising your to euthermic temperature, would cause the bat to burn through its energy reserves way too quickly. So in the end, the exact mechanism is still under investigation, but it's multifaceted.
Joel, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Luann?
To jump in and say that we've lost a lot of bats, and one of the things that many people don't know about these bat species is that they just have one pup a year.
Oh, is that right?
They're very long-lived animals, and so it's going to take many, many years for us to recover bat populations, even if some species survive this and develop ways to survive this fungus. And so the reason that we're studying maternity roosts and the reason that they're important is because that's how these bats are going to repopulate, is through reproduction. So being able to understand what their needs are, especially the females when they're raising pups, because the males have nothing to do with pup rearing, is really important.
Yeah. So how, you said they're long-lived. How long-lived?
Some bats can live to 30 years.
Wow.
And a northern long-ear could be a 20-year bat.
Oh, my goodness. So does this white nose syndrome impact other animals, or is it just bats?
We have not seen it infecting any other animal, any other taxon, so just bats.
Just bats. And when do the bats typically begin their migration or begin their winter hibernation?
So there's a little twist there in that all of our hibernating bats likely migrate very short distances. So we call them migratory versus hibernating bats, but even the hibernating bats do migrate to their winter sites, sometimes as much as 200 or 300 miles. Mm. The leaving from their summer sites usually starts to occur in mid-August. So by now, some of those summer sites have already declined in number because bats are migrating toward their winter sites. In between August and mid to late October, bats are at their swarming sites or at their hibernacula, the caves and mines where they hibernate, packing on pounds, packing on body fat to get through the winter, and also mating. So the mating season occurs now, starting in September and October. And then they go into hibernation in mid to late October, and they stay there through.
And then, so when do the pups born?
Almost fully half the year in our area when the bats are hibernating. They're in this torpid state of hibernation, relying solely on, or almost solely on, fat reserves.
Yeah. And so if they're mating now, when are the pups born? In the spring?
Pups are born in the spring. So they use a, the females store sperm, and that sperm doesn't then fertilize an egg until spring. Once the females emerge from hibernation, they will ovulate, and then there's fertilization, and that sort of kicks off the pregnancy period as early in the spring as possible, so that the pups can be born early in the summer as possible, and the pups then have a longer, the young of the year have a longer opportunity to fatten up before another hibernation season.
We're talking about the northern long-eared bat in response to white nose syndrome, which we are not finding on Martha's Vineyard. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about white nose syndrome, which is killing a lot of bats in the Northeast. The northern long-eared bat has taken such a hit, it's now threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. Glimmer of hope, northern long-eared bats on Martha's Vineyard so far have displayed no signs of white-nose syndrome. We're talking about that with Jonathan Reichard, National White-Nose Syndrome Assistant Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Luann Johnson, Director and Wildlife Biologist at Biodiversity Works, and Liz Baldwin, Assistant Director and Wildlife Biology, a biologist at Biodiversity Works. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. So, Luann, you've, this summer, was tagged 9 females?
Yeah, well, 10 total we tagged. Yeah.
Right. And tell us what you're learning about them.
So we, as Liz was saying, we attached the nanotags to these females, and we followed them every day. We located where they were spending the day. And because the females were lactating when we caught them, we knew that they had pups. Mm-hmm. So we located a colony in the Lambert's Cove area of Martha's Vineyard, and then we also had one in the latter part of the maternity season down near Eggertown Great Pond. So we know that there are females breeding in two areas of Martha's Vineyard for sure this summer, and the Lambert's Cove area, we actually followed those 9 females to 24 different roost sites.
Wow!
In this pretty small area, in an area of about half a mile, I would say, and within that area as far as they moved. And in those 24 sites, they were using 8 structures, houses or sheds or garages. And they weren't inside of those buildings. They were actually on the under the trim boards, what people call the rake board, at the top of the edge of the roof where the shingles meet the edge of the roof. And they were back up in there. And they didn't spend every single night in the same roost. So the important thing to understand is they moved around. They actually moved their pups.
That's interesting, yeah. Now, how are these homeowners when you're sitting in the yard kind of checking out a bat hanging in their shed?
I'll let Liz answer that one.
Most of them were really into it, actually. And the bats like nice homes. So we had a nice view, and the homeowners were really into it.
So part of your work is finding more roosting and hibernation spots of the northern long-eared bats, and you're enlisting the help of the public. So tell us how.
So we have a survey on our website, biodiversityworksmv.org, and so we're asking the community to send in their sightings of roosting bats, winter and summer. We can't be everywhere at once, and we know a lot of people do have bats in their homes, so we're hoping that we can get some of that information. And then it says whether or not you want us to contact you, so if you say yes, then we'll contact you and try to take a look.
And this is just on the vineyard?
Yeah, but we'll take Cape, too, because we can always pass that information on to U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah, I was going to say, John, that's information you would be interested in as well?
It is, yeah. We don't have a thorough database for those summer sites, but our field office certainly would want to know where there are documented roost trees. Mm.
So what should people do if they find,
sites, I should say.
Yeah, find a bat with signs of white nose syndrome? What would you do if you saw that?
So I would first caution against, don't go looking for trying to inspect a bat. If you see a bat that's in a place where you could grab it, unless you're a permitted biologist and know what you're doing, don't go looking to see what's happening. But associated with white nose syndrome, there is atypical behavior that can be observed often in the winter time. So if you see bats flying around in the daytime in the winter, then calling the state Mass Wildlife Department and letting them know, or calling the New England field office and reporting that activity is something we'd want to potentially investigate. Again, we don't know much about where the bats of the islands in the Cape are hibernating, so finding locations where they are observed in the winter is of interest for sure.
So what are some ways people can maintain or improve habitat for bats or provide safe roosting spots?
I think the best way to do it is to just sort of pay attention to healthy habitats and healthy forests and check out your barns and attics before any modifications occur. These northern long-eared bats in particular roost in a lot of places, and they may be trees that you wouldn't ever expect them to be in, or they may be, you know, behind your shingles and beneath your siding, as Luann was describing. So paying attention not to harass those potential sites and doing some observations at night to see if you have bats flying around before you cut down some trees, before you reside or re-roof your house, is a good way to see if there are bats there before you take those actions.
I just want to chime in, too, and say that, you know, having dead standing trees is important for not just bats, but
woodpeckers,
other wildlife
species,
woodpeckers. The trees that our bats were roosting in, they usually were in a canopy, a forest that had a good canopy, but there was a small opening where this dead tree was, so it had a little bit of light exposure. Many of them, or several of them, probably a third of those trees were actually near the edge of near a road, and that was sort of an artificial opening. But they were a lot of them either were dead trees or trees with part of the tree was dead, or they had loose bark or they had a cavity in the tree, and the northern longears were the colony was in there. The largest number of bats we had come out of one tree when we did an emergence was 15.
Wow.
And that was at a house roost, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the tree roosts were variable, but we did have a tree that had, I think, 12 come out of the same, out of a cavity.
Wow, that's interesting. Karen's giving us a call from Katuit. Hi, Karen.
Oh, hi. I have a story that occurred back in 2001. I was accompanying my daughter's high school ecology class. It was the fall, and we visited the Mashpee Wampanoag Meeting House. I think that's the one off of Meeting House Road and Route 28 in Mashpee. There was a maternal colony of 350 little brown bats, and they were in the attic of the meeting house. We met Melvin Tuttle. I think he's a famous bat scientist. And during the evening, there were transmitters put on four of the bats, and we used echolocators to track them. Most of them headed over to John's Pond that night to catch mosquitoes, and we were told that each one would take about 600 mosquitoes. After that, the meeting house was renovated, and I don't know what happened to the bats, but Bat Conservation International is a great group. You can go online. I think it's batcon.org, and they have an awful lot of information. They've been tracking white nose syndrome as it's gone from state to state throughout the country and even into Canada. So it's a great resource.
All right. Karen, thanks for sharing that. We appreciate that. Yeah, thanks for the call. You know, we mentioned there's a lot of people who are scared of bats, don't like bats, but then there are people who love bats and they want to put bat houses up in their yards. Is that a good idea? I mean, what is there a certain place you're supposed to put them, a certain height? Or, I mean, how do you attract bats if you want to have bats in your yard? I know I'd like to have some bats eat the mosquitoes in my yard.
Attracting bats to a site is pretty difficult. It's never a bad idea to put up a bat house. I think it's a great thing to do. It can be a little bit unrewarding in that it's a lot of bat houses go unoccupied. So, like you're mentioning, placement is important. So a bat house that's put sort of on the edge of a clearing, so the bats can fly out and maybe have a little bit of space to fly before they're deep in a thicket. Mounting to a pole or the side of a house with a southern exposure where it gets some sunlight is also a good strategy. But it also depends on what species you have in your area. Mm-hmm. So for little brown bats mounting on the side of a house, or even for northerns, mounting on the side of a house might be the best strategy, but mounting on a pole might be a better strategy for, say, an Indiana bat somewhere else. Mm. So some exposure to daylight, clear flightway so it can get out and then dive into the forest once it's out.
How does the threatened designation for the northern long-eared bat potentially impact human activities on the vineyard or other places where the species are found? I mean, we're talking about, you know, cutting down trees or residing. I mean, are there some, you know, with that designation, does that, what kind of protection does that give them?
So any listed species, whether threatened or not, is protected from intentional, what we call take of that species, and that's direct killing or harassing of or harming the animal, as well as damaging its habitat. So as a listed species, the northern long-eared bat has that protection. We also have sort of outlined some additional conservation measures in a 4D rule, which gives a little bit of flexibility to those protections, particularly as it equates to forest management practices and bats and houses. So this is a species that we know is often encountered in houses, and public safety does not trump the protections there with this 4D rule. We've identified that a bat in a house can be removed, a northern long-eared bat in a house can be removed with some attention that way. And in terms of some clearing of sites and things like that, there's not a great deal of direct effect on what residents need to do, what private residents need to do. Federal agencies, on the other hand, would consult with Fish and Wildlife Service to make sure their actions aren't harming the species.
Right. Let's try to squeeze Alan in, who's calling from Orleans. Is Alan gone? Okay. You know, another thing we have up on our website, we talked how bats help control the insect and pest populations, but they find their prey. They grab with their wings? I mean, we've got this cool video. Liz, you found the video. Tell us.
Yeah, so they use echolocation to find their prey, and as they get closer and closer, the calls get more closer together, so it's called a feeding buzz, and then they kind of hone in. So echolocation, they're sending out a call, and then the echo is coming back, and then they know what it is. It's quite amazing. So they know it's a beetle versus a moth versus a house. And then as they move closer into that insect, they swoop it down with their wings into their tail membrane and then flip it up into their mouth. Yeah. So some
it's,
people
it's
think
it's a very cool video. So yeah. You want to check out our website and take a look at that. We'll also have links to some of the other things we're talking about.
And Mindy, I also wanted to mention that Mass Wildlife has a great homeowner's guide to bats. So people should check that out on their website.
And just about 30 seconds left. Can humans inadvertently spread white nose syndrome? You mentioned boots, so I'm wondering.
We take precautions against it. We don't have direct evidence of that having happened. However, spores of PD have been found on gear and on people, and so we use cleaning decontamination protocols to make sure that there's no inadvertent spread of white nose syndrome. A universal precaution against contributing to the spread of the disease.
Well, Jonathan Reichard, National White Nose Syndrome Assistant Coordinator for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Luann Johnson, Director and Wildlife Biologist at Biodiversity Works, and Liz Baldwin, Assistant Director at Wildlife Biologist at Biodiversity Works. Your cards have to be so long. Thanks so much, and keep us updated on the research. It's really fascinating. We've so many questions.
Thanks,
Mindy. Might be able to answer. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.